Hello, and welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. My name is TJ. I'm standing in for Dan Shustak today, your host for this spring seminar series. This annual lecture series is funded by MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. Tonight's presentation will last about 45 minutes, and then we will have about 10 minutes for questions and answers. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Joe Elkington. Joe Elkington is a professor of entomology in the Department of Environmental Conservation at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He is an author of dozens of book chapters and scientific research articles on the topic of invasive forest insects. His work has appeared in numerous journals, including Ecology, Environmental Entomology, Molecular Ecology, Ecologia, and various others. Dr. Elkington's laboratory conducts research on population dynamics and biological control of invasive forest insects. His early work focused on gypsy moth and the impact of small mammal predators and viral and fungal pathogens on that system. More recent projects focus on the population dynamics of the brown-tailed moth, hemlock woolly adelgid, and winter moth. He is currently involved with efforts to introduce predatory beetles to control hemlock woolly adelgid and a tachinid parasitoid to control winter moth. We are glad to have Dr. Elkington here to share his research with us tonight. Please help me welcome Dr. Elkington to MCLA.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, so I work on invasive forest insects, and the two I will talk about tonight are defoliators. They feed on forest trees or shade trees. Some of them, you may have them in your own yards if you live here in eastern Massachusetts and various places. So the first one I'll talk about is gypsy moth. It's been, for more than a century, it's been a major problem in the eastern United States, and winter moth is a new invasive that showed up about 15 years ago in eastern Massachusetts. I'll talk about these various topics. So, gypsy moth. Well, the red areas show where gypsy moth defoliated last summer. So if any of you live in these areas, you may have seen this firsthand. It's a very dramatic event. All the leaves of the trees disappear in midsummer. It was a big surprise for us because gypsy moth had became a non-pest back in 1989. So it's been 35 years since the last major outbreak. And so why did it occur this year? Well, it has to do with the drought, and I will explain why that is. Gypsy moth is a caterpillar that hatches just in the first week of May, and caterpillars grow through several instars. They get larger in the end of June. So they feed on trees and they defoliate trees, and then they pupate on the trees, and then the adults emerge in midsummer. The females are white, the males are brown. Only the males do the flying, and the female produces a sex pheromone that attracts males. They mate, and she lays this egg mass. And that egg mass contains about 600 eggs, and that's what overwinters, and the caterpillars emerge the following spring. So the densities of gypsy moth in some of these areas have been enormous, just amazing. Hundreds of females shown on this tree here. Thousands, each one of those egg masses contains 600 eggs. There might be a million eggs in one tree. It's amazing when densities are that high, and it's really devastating. So the last big outbreak occurred beginning in the 1980s. That's the first year I moved to Massachusetts. I've been here a while, and so we had defoliation throughout the West. Out here in the Berkshires, we don't get so many defoliation because it's mostly a maple forest out here. But eastern Massachusetts is dominated by oak trees. And then that was 1980. 1981 looked like that. Virtually the whole state was defoliated. And we may be facing something similar to this in the coming year because we had very high levels of infestation that and high level of egg mass in many areas. Probably not this bad, but not far from it. So in the top graph, I took this picture in 1981, not far from where I live in Holly Grange, on July 4th. Not a leak to be seen. It's a very dramatic event. So you may have seen some of them if you drive on the turnpike near Palmer, east from Palmer or Springfield. You saw a lot of that this year. The same scene in a normal year shows looks like that. Very dramatic event. So this shows defoliation in Pennsylvania, which has had gypsy moth as almost as long as we have, and it's, you know, virtually there's not a leaf to be seen. This is midsummer, looks like wintertime. Very dramatic and very serious to the forest trees. So let's talk about how gypsy moth got here. It comes from Europe, it crawls all the way across Europe, and Europe is typically not a problem. That's often the case with invasive species. They're not a problem where they come from because they have under good biological control. Natural enemies keep them in check. But the gypsy moth came to Massachusetts. In fact, we know exactly how it got here. It was brought in by this gentleman named Leopold Truffolo, and he was doing some experiments with gypsy moth way back in 1868. But they didn't have much knowledge in those days about the dangers of something like this, and they escaped from his yard, and the rest is history. So it took a very long time for gypsy moth to spread across Massachusetts and the eastern United States because the females don't fly. The females have wings, but they don't fly. So it's only the caterpillars blowing from one tree to the next. So they moved very slowly. It took almost 50 years to cross Massachusetts. So 1915, almost 50 years later, it hadn't even crossed Massachusetts. But it's been slowly but surely spreading across the eastern United States. So recently it's spreading into the Midwest. So let's talk about what the gypsy moths like to feed on. They like certain kinds of trees better than others. They feed on many kinds of trees. Oak trees are one of the most favorite trees. Birch trees, these are the most favorite trees. But they will, in outbreak populations, you can see pine trees defoliated and hemlocks and various trees defoliated. There are only a handful of trees that they won't eat at all. And one of them is ash trees, which have their own threats you may have heard about. Emerald ash borer, but where I come from in Pennsylvania, yellow poplar or tulip poplar is shown here. Have complete defoliation, but the gypsy moth won't touch it at all. So there's a few trees the gypsy moth touch, but vast majority of trees. So the rest of these trees are defoliated. This tulip poplar or yellow poplar was not touched at all. Anyway, the gypsy moth control is really an interesting story. So this shows back in the 1890s, about 1890, gypsy moth became a big problem in the Boston area. And they did, you know, crazy things. I mean, look at those guys way up in the tops of those trees up there. I mean, that was, you know, that's not very safe to be doing that. But at any rate, they're scraping egg masses. And they have flamethrowers. They brought in lead arsenate. If you can believe that, they sprayed tons of lead arsenate on the Boston suburbs. Lead and arsenic both being very toxic. So they had no concept of how dangerous some of these materials were. Then, in 1905, they began a biological control project, and that's the kind of stuff that I do. So they introduced parasitic flies and wasps that attack gypsy moth from Europe. So this one, this egg parasite, it's a tiny little thing about the size of a pinhead, and it laid its own egg inside the gypsy moth egg on the egg masses. That comes from Japan. There's several species of flies that the larval fly develops inside the gypsy moth caterpillar. This is a pupal parasitoid, a little wasp that lays its own egg inside the gypsy moth pupa shown there. And those things will kill the caterpillar or the pupa, and they're part of the reason why it's not a problem in Europe, because most of these species come from Europe. But the problem is you need to do this very carefully. You can't just willy-nilly. And back in those days, they didn't understand the dangers. You can't just willy-nilly introduce these things, because some of them in their own right will then go on attacking native species. So we have a fly, for example, that we researched in my lab. It came in 1906 that now attacks giant silk moths, which is one of our, like Luna moths and Cecropia moths. And this is something that's not a good idea. So you have to do this very carefully. You have to do a lot of research before you introduce, you focus on specialists. So that's biological control is what I do. And it involves introducing predators or pathogens from invasive species and from the countries of origin. So you go to the country of origin and you do some research and find out what keeps it from being a problem there. So you've learned about invasive weeds in this class. Cynthia Butner, whom I know, we'll talk to you about water chestnuts. So there's a big effort in various places to introduce weed biocontrol here. But you gotta do that, you gotta do it safely, because you can't do it just willy-nilly. Is it safe? It's safe if you do the appropriate research. If you make sure that whatever you introduce is a specialist. So if it's a specialist, it'll feed on the target insect and then control its own density by reducing the density of the target insect. So we have to do careful what's called host range testing. We don't introduce something that feeds on many things. We introduce something that feeds on only the target insect or plant that we're focusing on. So that's biocontrol. Well, on with the history. Back in DDT was invented in the World War II era, just about before 1945. And so after the war, scientists thought that DDT was the solution to all problems. So they, you know, this shows the aerial application of DDT to Scranton, Pennsylvania. It was ridiculous. They didn't understand the dangers of DDT, which maybe you've heard about. So this woman wrote this famous book, Rachel Carson, called Silent Spring, showing that DDT has a serious effect on many species, particularly things like eagles and osprey. DDT accumulates in the fat body of insects, and it magnifies up this food chain. It doesn't break down. So we've lost most of our eagle populations, osprey populations, which are only just now recovering. Well, DDT was finally banned after this book was published. And they went on to produce other pesticides which are less damaging. But by and large, well, when I moved to Massachusetts in the 1980s, the state was still spraying large areas with pesticides. We had safer pesticides in those days, but I think we've realized that populations of gypsy moth and things eventually collapse on their own accord, and it simply doesn't make sense either environmentally or ecologically to use these aerial application projects. I mean, people still control pests, insects like gypsy moth on their backyard shade trees. I don't object to that, but the era of widespread aerial application, I think, is over with. And then the national effort nowadays is based on these pheromone traps. So pheromone traps is called the milk carton trap. It's baited with the natural sex pheromone of the gypsy moth female, and she releases that sex pheromone to attract males. Well, we know what that compound is, and we can produce it synthetic in the lab. So they have these traps that are deployed all across the landscape in the Midwest, from Wisconsin all the way to North Carolina. It's a huge effort. And this effort is, so what these colors show is that the different numbers of male gypsy moths, it basically maps the invasion front of gypsy moth across the landscape, which is now in the Midwest. And so the dark colors indicate lots of males. And the whole purpose of the project is to identify these new infestations, like there's one right here in North Carolina. And they go in and they permeate the forest with pheromone. It's non-toxic, but the females can't find males, so it's called the confusion technique, and they in this way they're able to eliminate the population. The same technique that doesn't work up here in Massachusetts or in New England, because there's simply too many gypsy moths. So the focus now is to try and keep this population from spreading further south and west as fast as it's doing. So, well, my research at UMass really focuses on what we call population dynamics or population ecology, what causes the rise and fall of populations and gypsy moths. So I did a lot of work in those days. This shows the trying to understand this process. This shows the area defoliated by gypsy moth over the decades since the early 1920s. And you see that big outbreak in 1981 shown here. Most of the state was defoliated, but we had other outbreaks that occurred in prior years. So prior to the 1980s, we had an outbreak about every 10 years, and interestingly, they were synchronized across the landscape. So this shows the defoliation. Again, this is acres defoliated in different states. So that shows the 81 outbreak, but some of the other outbreaks have been synchronized. So this is Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. The outbreaks were occurred simultaneously across the region, and that has to do with the weather events that drive these populations. But as I said, they introduced these 10 species of parasitoids to try and control gypsy moth. Unfortunately, none of them, each one of them has their own limitation. Some of the parasitoids have parasites that attack them. So together, they didn't really control the population. Small mammal predators cause feeding on the larvae and the pupae, which is actually what regulates the population. So these are mice, and they climb trees, and they feed on the larvae and the pupae. And so a bunch of researchers suggests that they they're important at low density, whereas in high density populations, you have this virus disease that comes in. And that's a naturally occurring regulatory factor. So this shows dead caterpillars hanging from the trees. It's kind of an amazing phenomenon. It's kind of disgusting. The caterpillars kind of melt and they drip out of the trees. And they're loaded down with this virus particles that kills the caterpillars. And the way the virus is transmitted, it sort of goes splush on the leaves. And the caterpillars will feed on virus-contaminated leaves and become infected themselves. So it's transmitted orally. And so in a high-density population, it's almost inevitable that a caterpillar will encounter virus, whereas in low-density populations where you have just a handful of caterpillars per tree, they almost never encounter virus. So that's the virus that really takes off in these high-density populations. So that shows what the idea here is, that gypsy moths grow over about four orders of magnitude, from about 1 to 10 to 100, just on a large scale of 1,000 to 100,000 egg masses per acre. So right now, in many places, we have densities in this range, hundreds of, not thousands of egg masses per tree, and that's when the virus takes off. So this is mortality plotted against density of gypsy moth. The virus takes off in high density, but in low-density populations, we have small mammal predators that are able to regulate the population. They eat most of the gypsy moths in these high-density populations. So the basic concept here in population ecology is that in all populations, you have a balance between mortality and density. And as the density of the host increases, gypsy moth increases, the mortality steadily increases until it reaches where it balances the birth rate. So each female is laying about 600 eggs, so it's a lot of mortality. So in order for, right here, where the two come together, the per capita birth rate and the per capita death rate means that each female is replacing herself once, so the population then remains stable. Over up here, the mortality is higher than the density, then the population collapses back, so there's sort of an equilibrium that's established. And that's true of almost any natural population. There's an equilibrium over time between mortality and fecundity. And so, for gypsy moth, a gypsy moth lays 600 eggs. That means in order for the population to remain stable, all but one of those eggs must die before they reach maturity. So that takes a lot of mortality. In other words, if only 200, if 300 female eggs, one of them must survive, and that means 299 must die. So that's a lot of mortality in order to stabilize a gypsy moth population. That's true of many insects. They have high levels of fecundity that require high mortality to balance them. So the idea is that it takes very high levels of mortality, up over 99%. So the population might be stable here, but when small mammals eat most of them and other things kick in, and then also when the virus kicks in at high density. But in this intermediate range, when the population grows, there's an idea that the predators become saturated. So there's an intermediate range of density where the mortality declines as the density increases, because there's only so many gypsy moths that one mouse can eat. And the mice don't vary much in density. They don't increase with the gypsy moth, so the gypsy moth kind of gets away from them in this region here. The higher the density, up here they're eating more than 90% of the caterpillars. There's so many gypsy moths up here that they can feed all day, and they don't cause enough mortality to balance the population. So the population in the nest phase sort of explodes exponentially into an outbreak phase that then causes defoliation. This is sort of a general model that's true of many insects of many population systems. I did a lot of work with mice back in the 1990s. So they had various plots around the Quabbin Reservoir and on Cape Cod. And we showed that mice and gypsy moths are linked. So this shows densities of mice on different plots over time, and densities of gypsy moth in different plots over time. These are low-density populations. No defoliation is going on, but because they're being regulated by the mice. But the mouse densities go up and down. When the mice go up, the gypsy moths tend to go down. And so that's what draws the mouse densities. It's acorn crops. Acorns are the overwintering food supply for the mice. So when the acorn crops go down, so do the mice, and that's what happens in our study plot. So we had a big acorn crop bust in 1992. They dropped, two orders of magnitude, almost no acorns. The mouse densities then the following summer also did drop about an order of magnitude, and the gypsy moth increased about an order of magnitude. So we showed that the whole system is being driven by acorn crops. So this shows when mouse densities are high, gypsy moths tend to decline. So everything above this line is an increasing population. This is the rates of change of the population. When the mouse densities are low, gypsy moth populations tend to increase. When they're high, they tend to decrease. And so this is the basic notion that we developed, that the failure of the acorn crop leads to a decline of mouse density and then an outbreak of gypsy moth. So it shows that mice can control gypsy moth, but they're dependent on a good acorn crop to keep mouse density high. So that we were doing that work, and just when we thought we understood, an amazing event happened. We had an introduction of a new pathogen, a fungal pathogen called Entomophaga myemiga, that suddenly killed gypsy moths all over the state. I walked out into the forest one day, and there were dead gypsy moths everywhere. I'd never seen anything like it, and it was a new fungal pathogen of gypsy moth that comes from Japan. So that it caused a lot of press in those days, because it happened all over the Northeast, and it caused the caterpillars to die in the following fashion. You can still see these in the forest today. The caterpillars die head down. They have this little dusting of fungal spores that are producing these conidia that blow in the wind. So these are airborne conidia, the fungal spores that blow across the landscape and affect gypsy moth. And so this happened in that year, and it's linked to rainfall. The fungus, like many fungal diseases, like if you grow squash plants or something in your yard, in a rainy year you get a lot of fungus diseases on your squash plants. Same with gypsy moth. When the fungus is present, there's a lot of rain. The spores require rainfall. They fly, the spores fly through the air and they land on a caterpillar. If the caterpillar is wet because of its raining condition, the spore will germinate, penetrate the caterpillar, and kill the caterpillar. So you have this process of spore production. It totally changed the ecology of gypsy moth. So I mentioned the virus disease earlier. The virus causes, this shows more density of gypsy moth plotted against mortality. The virus has caused very little mortality at low density, but in high density populations, it causes a lot of mortality up to 100%. The fungus is completely different. It causes high mortality even in low density populations. So it completely changed the ecology of gypsy moth. It changed it from a major problem into a non-problem, a non-pest. And that's true of most of our native, we have hundreds of species of caterpillars out in our forest, any of which could be like gypsy moth, but they're kept in check by these natural enemies. In this case, the fungus disease, in other cases, it's parasites like I talked about before, and so that provides an opportunity when you have an invasive species. You can do the kind of research. My colleagues tried to introduce this fungus. The fungus came here naturally. Where did it come from? Well, my colleague Ann Hayek at Cornell introduced the fungus in the early 1980s. For whatever reason, she didn't have the right strain, so it never got established. So we think a strain here got here accidentally from Japan. It's known in Japan where it controls gypsy moth there. So it came in gypsy moth in New England accidentally. There was a lot of commerce between us and Japan, and it turned gypsy moth into a non-pest. Gypsy moth is a non-pest mostly where it comes from, so it sort of reestablished the balance of nature that occurs in Europe and Asia for the most part. So that shows the opportunity. This shows the rainy conditions that occurred in those days. In that year, we had a very heavy rainfall in southern New England, where we had the dark blots indicate the presence of the fungus, the yellow blots indicate gypsy moth that didn't have the fungus. So the mortality in 1989 occurred all over New England, but not in western Pennsylvania. Even though the green showed the level of rainfall, we had high levels of rainfall over the whole region, including western Pennsylvania. So if the fungus had been there, it would have caused a lot of mortality, but it wasn't there yet. So it showed that it sort of spread all over New England in one year, because we hadn't seen it before. But then in the next year, this shows the same data, is solid. The solid circles indicate the presence of the fungus. The open ones ensure that the fungus did not occur in gypsy moth. But look here this is 1989 that I showed you before. The following year, in 1990, it spread about halfway across Pennsylvania. So The story is that this fungus spread very quickly, unlike gypsy moth. This fungus, it blows in the wind. There's little spores that are everywhere, and they blow in the wind and spread all across the landscape on its own. So by about 1996, it was everywhere across the wherever gypsy moth was in those days, including Michigan. Well, we sent spores to Michigan. We dug soil in the Quavon Reservoir and sent it to our colleagues in Michigan, and they established the fungus there. So within a few years, the fungus was everywhere. We did the same thing in southern Appalachia. So we helped spread it around, but the fungus basically turned gypsy moth into a non-pest. So the ecology of the system completely changed following the introduction of the fungus. So now it's all driven by rainfall, because the fungus requires rainfall. So in a year when you have, this shows the blue bars indicate high rainfall, and this shows the gypsy moth population, but this is high levels of entomophaga, or the fungus, are associated with high levels of rainfall this year and this year. And when there's less rainfall, there's lower levels. So that explains what's going on now. So the presence of this fungus completely changed gypsy moth ecology. So now the whole thing is determined by the amount of rainfall you get in May and June, which explains why we all of a sudden, after 35 years, we started to have major problems with gypsy moth again. Because as you may remember, last May and June, we had very dry conditions. It's been dry for three consecutive years in May and June, and the fungus just never reached the epidemic proportions that you need to control gypsy moth. So this shows the rainfall data. In 2013 was a normal year. We had 12 inches of rain during this period. In the last 3 years, we've had much less than that, and that's why the gypsy moth takes off. The fungus is no longer working. So what's the prognosis for the coming year? If you live in some of these areas, we will probably have, because of all the egg masses, we'll probably have a lot of gypsy moth this coming year. But overall, longer term, nature should, we're getting a lot of rainfall now, and hopefully it'll be a wet spring, so nature should reassert itself. The fungus should take off again, and long term, I think gypsy moth is much less of a problem than it used to be because we have this fungus established. It's a permanent fix on the system. It shows the opportunities for biocontrol, even though we didn't introduce it intentionally. By bringing in the right natural enemies, they can convert these major problems into non-problems. So you've been studying invasive weeds in this class. Well, there are projects around the world to introduce insects to feed on those invasive weeds. Again, it has to be done carefully. You can't just introduce anything that will eat the weeds. You have to look to study it to make sure it's not going to feed other things. But there are lots of opportunities and many famous successes around the world with this approach. Okay. Well, so I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about another invasive insect, which is more recent. And we have a big active biocontrol project on this one, too. It's called the winter moth. And if any of you live in eastern Massachusetts, you may have seen this. It's another defoliator. This shows apple trees that have been defoliated by winter moth. So it's just like gypsy moth. You get these outbreak of caterpillars that go in very high densities. And like gypsy moth, it feeds on many trees. In fact, it feeds on more trees than gypsy moth does. It loves maple trees, for example, which gypsy moth don't like so much. That's why you don't have so much gypsy moth out here in the Berkshire. It's been a big problem on blueberries, gypsy moth little winter moth caterpillars getting to the blueberries. So we first heard about this back in 2003. We heard about defoliation happening up on the North Shore and the South Shore of Boston. And we just assumed it was one of the native inchworms, little inchworm caterpillars. We have several native species. They sometimes cause outbreaks. But then we heard about flight that happened in, now Christmas time. There's no native species that does that. Really brought to mind the notion of winter moth, which is a European native. It's called winter moth because it flies in the wintertime. And that's what was happening. So that was confirmed by colleagues of mine at University of Connecticut who specialize on moth identification. And so this caterpillar has a one generation of years of like gypsy moth. Like gypsy moth, it overwinters in the egg stage shown here. Not an egg mass, the legs are laid singly. And they hatch in early spring. So this caterpillar is about an inch long. It's an inchworm. And it bores into the expanding leaves. They're just about to hatch right now. And as the leaves expand, they'll go into the opening buds. And a lot of the damage happens before the leaves actually open. You might have one bud on a tree. You might have 20 caterpillars. I mean, the densities, like gypsy moths, are enormous. 100,000 caterpillars per tree. It's not unusual. So once you have densities like that, the tree gets defoliated. And this caterpillar specializes in doing it, this thing early in May. It drops out of the tree by the end of May, to about May 20th or so, and then it goes down to the soil where it pupates. So there's the pupa, and that's down in the soil. And the adults emerge in November and December. Like gypsy moth, the females don't fly. In this case, the females have lost their wings altogether. Those are vestigial wings. She evolved from winged ancestors. They let the males do the flying, and the female devotes all her energy to egg production, which is one reason why they're so pestiferous. So we did a big survey with pheromone traps for gypsy moth, for winter moth, and the red shows where we found winter moth. The green shows we have a native insect called the Bruce Benrum that uses the same pheromone. But the native insect is everywhere. It's in one of the hundreds of caterpillars we have, which is not a non-problem. It's everywhere, but it's never at a high density. The winter moth goes, on the other hand, causes high levels of defoliation everywhere from eastern Long Island up through eastern Massachusetts and up into Maine. So we discovered they didn't know they had winter moth along the coast of Maine, but we knew it had been in Nova Scotia because it was introduced there back in the 1930s. So the distribution of winter moth matches the cold hardiness zones of the plant. This is the plant cold hardiness zones based on minimum winter temperatures, and shows that winter moth is somehow restricted to the coastal areas so far. It's very similar to the temperature map. So I was just interested to learn that Massachusetts had winter temperatures very similar to Nova Scotia, even though Nova Scotia is way far north. It's out here in the Gulf Stream, so it has very similar winter temperatures to Massachusetts. But so we know the winter moth came into Nova Scotia back in the 1930s, but because of the cold temperatures in New Brunswick here, winter moth basically stayed in North Scotia. But maybe it crept along the coast to Massachusetts. We're doing DNA studies to try and figure out, does our winter moth match Nova Scotia, or is it a new introduction from Europe? We think the latter is true based on our DNA studies, but that's another story which I won't elaborate on. Anyway, so the winter moth then proceeded to spread from North Shore and South Shore, shown in green here, over down into the South Shore and onto Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard and into Rhode Island. So this is defoliation from winter moth. So it's a serious defoliator, and it's a big problem on people's shade trees. And so, but the exciting thing is that winter moth, as I mentioned, was introduced to Nova Scotia in the 1930s, also to Vancouver, twice before in the early part of the 20th century. And in both cases, they completely solved the problem by introducing these parasitic flies, this parasitic fly and this parasitic wasp. And these, like these other parasites, they make a living by laying their egg on or in the host of the caterpillar, and then the larval fly or wasp develops inside the caterpillar. So this shows the winter moth pupa, which is down in the soil, and has the fly puparium inside it. So that's the winter moth pupa, that's the fly pupa. That fly has just killed this winter moth pupa. Same with this wasp. There's the adult wasp waiting inside the winter moth pupa, and then both the adults emerge in the spring and go find new hosts. So that's the way these parasitic insects make a living. And almost any caterpillar you find anywhere in the world would have a suite of these attacking it. So they play a critical role in keeping the population densities of almost any insect in check. So with the appropriate research, you can introduce these things. But again, it depends on making sure that whatever you introduce is a specialist and going to attack other things that you don't want it to attack. So this shows the Nova Scotia story. The red line represents defoliation from winter moth, and back in the 1950s. So the defoliation was severe, went on and on for about a decade, and they introduced the fly in 1954 and the wasp in 1956. And for several years they saw nothing, but then they had no recoveries. It took a while for these parasites to build up. There's one generation a year. But then in 1958 they had the first recoveries. In 1959 they had 10% parasitism. So 10% of these winter moth caterpillars were infected by this fly in 1959, and that went to 40% to 60% in 1961. The wasps also built up. So the two together knocked the winter moth down to low density starting in 1962. And in Nova Scotia, winter moth is a non-pest. It's been a non-pest forever, since 1962. It's a permanent solution. Nothing more needs to be done about this. So when you get the right thing to work, and it's not going to attack other species, it's a great solution to invasive species problem. So that's, but it doesn't always work, and you don't always have the right agent, but at any rate, so it was a no-brainer for us to try the same thing in Massachusetts. That's what we did, starting in 2005. So this shows some of the statements. This we introduced this fly. Hang on. So we introduced the fly and not the wasp. Why do we do that? The wasp is, it's a taxonomic, a model. We're not sure whether it's a one species or several species. It's a generalist. It seems to attack a wide range of species. So forget about it. We're not going to introduce it because we need to be sure about the species we're introducing. And we were very sure about this fly because it attacks only winter moth and not even other kinds of winchworms. So that's a safe insect to introduce because it's a specialist. So anyway, where do you collect the fly? Well, you collect the fly by collecting caterpillars. You go out and you collect the caterpillar. First, we went to Nova Scotia. Well, the winter moth densities are so low in Nova Scotia, you spend all day, you can't come back with a handful of caterpillars. You can't do it. But out in Vancouver Island, they've introduced winter moth back in the 1970s, and the fly got the fly established. So this shows a colleague out on Vancouver Island who's studying winter moth out there. And for whatever reason, the winter moth densities they're way down from what they were. I mean, these trees have not defoliated, but you can see there's a little bit of tattering, a little bit of holes. So winter moth densities are still somewhat high out there, and the fly is there, so we can collect caterpillars. So for 10 years, I hired people out on Vancouver Island. These are my moth kateers flew through. They spent, lab, Jeff Butner, he's the husband of Cynthia Butner, who gave a talk here. And he led a crew out there for, I think, like 7 straight years, I guess it was. And they spent all day knocking caterpillars down out of the trees and collecting caterpillars. And the caterpillars, about half the caterpillars have a fly inside them. So this shows Jeff's motel room. Each one of his buckets contains 500 caterpillars. So at the end of 6 weeks, he collected 120,000 caterpillars and reared them to the pupal stage. Bring back the pupae, go into the quarantine lab down at Otis Air Base on Cape Cod, make sure we had on introducing anything else, and rear out the fly. So we rear them, we hold them for a whole year, from May when we collect them until the following April, almost a whole year, and then we release the flies. So we release the flies in various locations around New England, and so this year we released 28,000 flies at 10 new sites. So slowly but surely, we've been getting the flies established. So across the winter moth landscape, from Southeast Connecticut to coastal Maine, we have released the flies, showing the different years of release. All the fly symbols indicate the locations where we have successfully established the flies. We've successfully established this fly at 21 locations. And how do you prove that? You go back the following year and you collect caterpillars and you find out whether they have a fly inside them. So we've established the fly, and that's the big one. And then the fly will take off on its own. Will it control gypsy moth? Well, just like in Nova Scotia, will it control winter moth? Well, it's a long time because there's only one generation of flies a year. So it takes several years before we even detect. This shows where we did the first release. So like in this site up here, we did the first release in 2006, 2007. We had no recoveries until 2012. The fly was out there, but it was slowly building up to a point where we could detect it. And so only, 10 years later, it's starting to cause large high mortality. The best success has been in Wellesley, where we have high levels of parasitism. So this shows a study we're doing in Wellesley, going in different directions from this. We established the fly first in about 2000, I think it was 2011, we got the first recovery. So this in 2015, we had 18% parasitism in the set where we had reached the fly. But each one of these points is a 1 kilometer or about 6/10 of a mile apart. And the numbers indicate percent parasitism. So in 2015, we had percent parasitism in reasonably high levels all across the town of Wellesley, but we were recovering parasites way out here in Newton, up here toward Lincoln, and out here toward, this is Fall River. So we're getting the fly established. And then the following year, we took the same data. Each one of these points is a kilometer apart. The white symbols indicate we had no recovery. So by 2016, we had recovery almost every site, including right into South Boston here. This is up into different locations in the Boston vicinity. So we've pretty much got the fly established over the whole western suburb of Boston, and indeed it's over much of eastern Massachusetts. We've established it's a big success. It's been a huge effort, but we've established the fly. But is it going to fix the problem? There's no guarantee. It did in Nova Scotia, so it ought to work here, but it took a while. It took them at least 10 years in Nova Scotia to get this to this place. But we're getting the same similar. So this shows the Nova Scotia data back in the 1950s. When the fly built up, shown in blue, knocking the winter moth population down, shown in red. So since 62, there have been no winter moth populations of any note in Nova Scotia. In Wellesley, the same thing is happening. The winter moth, this is defoliation from winter moth in red. The flies are established, and this is the density of winter moth pupae, which we collect in pupal buckets. The density has come down about, not something like 90% in Wellesley, and it's basically, we're in the process of converting winter moth to a non-pest in this region, I'm quite sure. But other things are important. So I have my graduate student, Hannah Broadley, shown here, is studying pupal predators. It takes a suite of these natural enemies. The pupal predators are important because they prey upon the larvae, pupae down in the soil, which were there from May until November. So that each one of these, there are many species of predatory beetles, and she's discovered a parasitic wasp that attacks the pupal stage and lays its egg in the pupae of winter moth. So it takes the suite of these natural enemies to bring them down. So, just like in gypsy moth, it takes a virus diseases and parasitoids and mice to bring the population under control. So it is with winter moth. We have different agents that are operating at different densities, and we think the fly is most important at high density, and these other pupal predators like the mice and gypsy moth, they may not be able to control the high density populations because they're generalists, that their numbers don't fluctuate with the winter moth. But if you bring the population down into this lower level, they can eat most of the winter moth pupae down in the soil. So, in order to document what's happening, you have to do a major study, not just the fly and the winter moth, but try and account for all these other mortalities going on in the system. And that's a huge effort. It's actually rarely done in these biocontrol projects. Often the system will work, but to actually document how it works and why it works is rarely accomplished. But we're trying to do that. And as long as I can keep it going, we'll keep it going. So we've now established the fly at 21 sites. Throughout eastern New England, and it's spreading all across the eastern suburbs. Particularly, the fly is well established. Will it convert winter moth into a non-pest like it did in Nova Scotia? It's pretty likely. It's doing well. It looks very promising, but we'll just have to wait and see whether it's really going to convert winter moth to a non-pest like gypsy moth is by and large now. But it shows the power of these biocontrol projects. When they work, they're permanent. Each problem is solved. You don't have to do anything else. We'll find out whether that's true here. Many people are involved in this project from all over the place. Different people in Canada and in different states are helping me out. All crew in my laboratory is involved. I have a wonderful group of people in my lab who are working on this project, so I'm very blessed to have these people working with me. And the USDA funds this work, by and large, the Forest Service and APHIS couldn't be done without their support. That's my story. Question? Yes?
I have a question on the biologicals. Can you suggest any that you think would work on any of the invasive plant species that we're working on?
Well, I don't know too much about this topic. I know Cynthia Butner, whom I know, gave a talk on that. I mean, there are some people working on biocontrol of water chestnut and also garlic mustard. I mean, it takes a lot of research. Because you don't want to introduce an insect that's going to feed on plants that we like. And so it's a much slower process. But there have been some spectacular successes, though. One of the successes that I'm aware of is out in the southwest is tamarisk, or salt cedar. It's been a huge problem in the river valleys of the Arizona, New Mexico, Utah. It invades the river valleys, and it draws down the water, and it dries all the other native plants to extinction. They have some predatory beetles that have really they cause defoliation of salt cedar, and they're specialists on salt cedar, so they don't spread to other things. So it's really been a big success. There's other successes. That Klamath weed is another weed that was controlled out in the West many years ago. Melaleuca is a forest tree in the Everglades. So there's all these projects all over the world, and some of which have been very spectacular. In Africa, there was a mite on, I forget the name of the crop plant, but there are various crop plants in Africa that have been controlled with it. So it's a worldwide effort, but it doesn't always work. There's not always an insect, and it has to be done extremely carefully, because obviously you don't want to introduce something that's going to spread onto crop plants. And stupid things have been done like that that have caused disasters, so we want to avoid that.
You talked about some parasites that you introduced for the gypsy moth.
Yes.
A long time ago. Do those insects still live around here?
Yeah, they do. I showed that egg parasitoid, that little thing that's on the egg mass. If you find a gypsy moth egg mass in late summer, look at the egg mass, and you can see these little tiny little wasps growing on. They kill about 30% of the egg. Their limitation is they only get the eggs on the very surface. So they don't control the population, but they contribute. Yes?
So you talked about those cartons with pheromones in them.
Yeah.
Can the public buy those and set them up in their trees?
It's a good question. You can buy them, but it doesn't control the population. So you can catch male gypsy moths or male winter moths. We use those to sample our winter moth population. So it's good for detecting where the population is and where it isn't. But in terms of controlling the population, you're not going to catch enough males in your yard to actually make a difference. Now, it does work in these isolated populations out ahead of the leading edge where there's just a few gypsy moths, and what they do is they spray the forest with these little plastic flakes that have the pheromone in it, and the females, the males are trying to find the females, but there's pheromone everywhere. So that actually works. But it's a very specialized conditions which does work. And for homeowners or for anything done here in Massachusetts, people have tried, but it doesn't work.
Do you have suggestions for people whose trees are infested with gypsy moths or winter moths?
Yeah, well, the biocontrols that I'm talking about are something that's not something the homeowner can use. It has to be a project like I do. For protecting your shade trees, I have no problem with people spraying their shade trees. I mean, people, because the amount of spraying that's done is so minuscule compared to what it used to be, the area of application. So, the pesticides that we have now are safer than they used to be. They're not like DDT. They break down. So that's what, if you're going to have a valuable shade tree, that's what I recommend. It's not going to regulate the population, but it'll protect your shade tree, and the population will collapse on its own accord very soon. You just have to do it once, and we're probably done. Yes.
But going on her question, when you do it, you have to do it a certain time of year.
Yes, absolutely. It's very important. I mean, you have to do it when the caterpillars are young, first of all, and you have to do it. Do it right before a rainstorm, which will wash the material off. So, I mean, the best thing to do is to contact your local arborist, who they have the equipment to do it. They have the training to know which materials to use and how to dispose of them safely. So, I mean, they're professionals. They know how to do it, and that's the way to go. It's expensive is the problem, because you should spend $100 per tree or something like that. So it's not something you do on a wide scale, but, everyone has beautiful shade trees in their yard they want to protect. Yes?
I was wondering, because hemlock lily adelgid hasn't hit the Berkshires this north yet.
Yeah.
But it's on its way, and we talked about in the intro that you are working with predatory beetles.
Yeah.
What does the progress look like on that?
We've introduced one predatory beetle that looks quite promising. It's called Laracopius nigrans. The larvae, the beetles feed on the adult stages of the adelgid, and the larvae feed on the eggs. I'm doing, so it remains to be seen whether this beetle is well established in the South, where it seems to be having an effect. I'm doing work out in Seattle, where the adelgid occurs naturally, and it seems like the beetles control it there. But there are other things, not just the beetles, there are other things. So it's a work in progress, right? And the beetles don't seem to, neither the adelgid or the beetles survive our cold winters very well up here in the north, up here in New England. The Adelgid itself comes from Japan, Osaka, Japan, which has a maritime climate and almost never freezes there. So it's not very well adapted, but neither is the beetle. So we haven't reached success here, but we're working hard on it. And, you know, out here in the Berkshires, because it's a lot colder here than in eastern Massachusetts, the Adelgid is only just hanging on and barely established. I guess we're done, huh? Yeah. Thank you.